Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, and as ever, I am joined by Ian Wenick. Ian, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'll make no visual references in this intro today.
Excellent. And we're also joined today by Sam Bojarski. Sam, how are you?
Doing well. It's been quite the week.
Yeah, it really has. A lot going on, as ever. So let's get straight into it. We're going to kick off this week with a story that you wrote, Sam, a regulatory story about a proposal by FINRA. And this proposal, some people are saying, sound like Donald Trump there, a lot of people are saying it could have a chilling effect on RIAs. So before we get into what that effect might be and who's saying it, what is the proposal? What's at the heart of this?
Yeah, so broker-dealers have long been required by FINRA to supervise certain outside business activities of their registered representatives. This proposal, FINRA's stated goal is to kind of narrow the scope of those outside activities that would have to be disclosed to member firms to investment-related activities. And so, you know, obviously that involves someone's RIA business if they're also registered at an outside RIA.
Okay, so this is the crux of it, right? You're an RIA or you're dual registered, but let's say predominantly your business is as an RIA and you have a certain amount of brokerage business, but maybe less of your overall asset mix, client mix, what have you. But you do that through a broker-dealer, and that broker-dealer now would have to be across everything you were doing in your RIA business, sort of securities and trades-wise. Is that the gist of it? Have I got that right?
Well, like the existing regulations, they have to disclose all of that already. If they're receiving, like, for instance, asset-based compensation as an RIA, they've long been required to disclose that to their broker-dealer firm. But there's some language within this proposal that's given certain parties, cause for concern. Most specifically, like, are they going to be allowed? Are they going to have to disclose specific securities transactions to their member broker dealer that they're registered with?
Okay, this is what we're getting at here. So yeah, every trade they might make for a client, for example, they would now have to disclose. Previously, they just had to disclose that they were getting that income, that they had that business. Mm-hmm. But the granularity of what they'd have to disclose would be much, much greater.
Right.
Potentially, if critics of this proposal have their interpretation correct.
That's what the concern is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if they're, and obviously, like, advisors are typically only making decisions on trades, and the concern is, like, is even that activity going to be subject to a member broker dealer supervision, each trade decision?
Got it, okay. And then I suppose then, so that would be an issue for both the broker dealer that would now have to be across a bunch more clients and in a much more granular sort of way, but also obviously a big issue for those RIAs that would then have to start reporting that to their broker dealer as well, whereas previously that was none of their concern, which
exactly
could be onerous, could be very costly, could be very time consuming, could just be a real pain.
Yeah. And Persh Kaplan Sterling put in a comment letter on FINRA's proposal, and their CEO told me that, you know, he might have to hire more compliance staff if this rule goes into effect. Yeah.
Because they have what? So he said he worked with around 650 RIAs?
Yeah, they're mm-hmm. an RIA-friendly broker-dealer. So specifically designed to act with independent firms. They did a lot of work with, like, Dynasty Financial Partners as a good example. They did a lot of their BD work.
Okay, got it. So they would be particularly hard hit. But there's also lots of other broker-dealers who obviously
yeah, there's a ton
RIAs
that do this.
Who'd be in the same position. Who described it as chilling? Was that Persh Kaplan, or was that someone else?
I'm an attorney, Brian Hamburger, who represents a lot of BD firms and RIAs. Yeah.
And what was his rationale for that? Again, just the onerous nature of what these requirements could be.
Yeah. Just possible new compliance obligations on broker dealers that could, like, you know, make advisor representatives, like, less likely to engage in certain business activities.
Okay, and he sort of feels like it could be FINRA kind of trying to insert itself into the regulation of RIAs, which is otherwise generally done by the SEC.
Yeah.
Okay, and I suppose what's FINRA said about this. So the timeline of this, if I have this right, and obviously correct me if I don't, was the proposal came out in March. Mm-hmm. It's been open for comment since then. And what we're hearing, I suppose, is some of the comment that's been given back to FINRA and obviously circulated more broadly. Has FINRA responded to, I suppose, our story or the comments that it's got so far as part of this proposal?
Yeah, I mean, well, the proposal was released in March, but over the last like week or two, it's gotten a flurry of comments. So FINRA has felt compelled
all of this nature, kind of all of the sort of somewhat critical, concerned.
Yeah, concerned. You know, some are citing like data security concerns, like, you know, turning over client data potentially to like member broker dealers, RA client data, that is. But yeah, FINRA has issued a note of clarification saying that, you know, we're basically just going to maintain the status quo for RIA representatives.
Okay, so they're saying it won't be as chilling, but what the worry is that FINRA is saying one thing, but the language in the proposal says something different. Is that what critics would suggest?
Yeah, that's the concern. Yeah, that there's more obligations than perhaps
they're saying
meet
there
the
is.
Eye, essentially. Yeah.
Okay. When do we get a resolution on this? When would the proposal become a rule, and I suppose when would we know for sure what the impact could be?
Well, public comments open for another week. I believe it closes next week, and then FINRA will evaluate those comments, go to the drawing board, and issue a final rule in several months.
Ian, anything else you wanted to come in on this particular point?
No, I just think that it's interesting because I get why even some of these BDs wouldn't want it, because it just ups their responsibility and by extension their risk exponentially. I mean, PKS having to hire double the staff. I mean, think about just the sheer jump in terms of sheer trading activity they'd have to monitor now.
Yeah, so bad for both sides of the coin, effectively. Yeah. And I think to what Brian Hamburger was saying in Sam's piece, obviously that would sort of could put the brakes on or have a chilling effect indeed on sort of independence, because, you know, you can no longer go solo but then affiliate with a broker dealer for this part of your business. The broker dealer wouldn't necessarily want to have you. You would have second questions about doing it too. So yeah, impact could be big.
Exactly. Neither side wants it.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting.
Oh, the one other thing I can say about this rule too is that in instances where, like, say a broker dealer and an RIA are under common ownership, FINRA did say explicitly that, like, that person's advisory activity, if they're registered with both, doesn't fall under these supervision requirements. So they're relaxing the rules there for those advisors.
So again, to should we say Brian, Mr. Hamburg? I'm not sure. It feels silly to keep saying someone's full name. But again, okay, to Brian's point, it could have sort of puts the brakes on independence to some degree, because it favors you sort of staying where you are, staying in that shared ownership structure, as opposed to going out on your own, where the reporting requirements would be potentially more onerous. Mm-hmm. Interesting, because you don't really see anything that's put the brakes on the independence movement, nor necessarily should there be, but just an interesting kind of potential twist. Fantastic. All right, well, look, speaking of, I don't know if this is speaking of independence, I was trying to do some sort of awkward segue to our next section, Ian, but I'm gonna backtrack and go with this. Welcome to another episode of This Week in LPL and Commonwealth, because that's sort of where we are again. It doesn't roll off the tongue in quite the same way, but it is the dominant story of the year, I suppose, in RIA land to some degree. And obviously we spoke about it at a certain length last week, but we're back on it again, listener, but for good reason. There's been a good update. So just to set the scene here, generally, obviously, as discussed, there's something of a feeding frenzy since this deal was announced. Obviously, LPL wants to recruit, retain as many of those Commonwealth advisors as possible. Some of those advisors seem to have some concern or skepticism about, you know, life under that new structure. And in the meantime, lots of rivals have tried to get in on the act and offer their own services and or incentives for those advisors. And LPL is obviously not taking that lying down, Ian.
Yes, that's correct. So LPL has been making a full court press to court Commonwealth advisors. So we report exclusively early in the week. We discovered several videos that top LPL executives, most notably CEO Rich Steinmeier, sent to Commonwealth's advisor population. And these were conducted as interviews between Rich or LPL's chairman with top Commonwealth executives, basically asking and answering questions beyond the FAQs on the website.
We should specify here, it's not just him recording stuff on his phone and sending it out to, it was a very professional.
Yeah, very professional.
Set up conversations with him and sort of Commonwealth executives, effectively trying to pitch the firm, really, or reassure those advisors that LPL was the place for them to be. What were the most interesting takeaways for you from these videos?
Yeah, I mean, I think one is they're definitely making promises about ongoing support. So you hear Rich Dimmer say, we're not going to take away your service teams, we're trying to preserve your community. And that is kind of the theme that wound its way through all these videos. You want to take making critiques of competitors. So I think the best example would be Fidelity and NFS, which is the primary custodian for Commonwealth advisors. Well, when Commonwealth moves to LPL, a lot of those assets have to move off of Fidelity's custodial platform. And Rich tried to address this head on. He said, basically, if Fidelity wanted to keep the Commonwealth community together, they would have bid. And he repeatedly insisted throughout these videos filmed more than a week apart. The core element they try to get is that LPL was the only firm that bid to keep Commonwealth together, that every other bidder, identities which we don't know yet, emphasis on yet, would break Commonwealth apart and break the advisor teams apart. And so the whole pitch, the whole theme, it all centers around keeping the community together and putting what needs to be in place to keep it together.
Okay, and he's saying no one else wanted to do that.
Exactly.
So, you know, okay. We'll come, I want to come back in a minute to the other sort of things that he sort of promised or vowed would remain in place or would be worth sticking around for. But you've started this conversation now about sort of taking swipes at rivals. So he took that dig at Fidelity, said, you know, they didn't bid for you. They didn't want to keep you together. We did. Not the only firm that he took a couple of pot shots at. So let's get into that because it's kind of fun. And then we'll come back to the sort of the more, you know, serious stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what's also interesting is that he took a shot kind of at Raymond James, which is one of the firms that's making a really aggressive bid both through its brokerage business and its RA custody business to get Commonwealth advisors to leave and move over to their platform. And so LPL is a public company, and Rich, while talking about LPL status as a public company, why it'd be a strength, he said, I'm going to read it verbatim so that we don't get it wrong. He said, you get to see externally 17 analysts rate us, 16 analysts have us buy rated, one has us sell rated. That's Raymond James. You tell me whether you think they're biased or not.
Ouch. Yeah, good one. Okay, and then let's keep going through these because, as I say, it's kind of fun. Also, Ameriprise, which is sort of like LPL's sort of mega rival at this point. They seem to have wars on multiple fronts.
You finally opened the door for me to make my pop culture references. You know, the Thanos, Skeletor, Darth Vader, whatever you want to describe it. That's their big bad. But yeah, I mean,
I was worried you were going to get a Pokemon reference. Anyway, let's keep moving.
So basically, look, for context, and you've listened to it if you're a loyal reader of this podcast, that LPL and Commonwealth and LPL and Ameriprise have had litigation with each other related to advisors moving. LPL claimed that Ameriprise defamed it when Ameriprise circulated a data breach notice to clients who might have moved over from LPL. And basically, Rich Steinmeier made direct reference to Ameriprise when it talked about advisor sense of independence and data protection, and he said, again, quoting verbatim, it's your business, it's your data. You're never going to get some nonsense that you get out there in the marketplace from like Ameriprise, who won't let advisors who they claim are independent take their data with them. You're not getting that from us. It's actually your business. We actually, to our souls, believe that.
Excellent. That was a very nice rendering of Rich Steinmeier. I think you got the pathos across there. So congratulations on both, you know, giving our readers information, but also giving them a real sense of who the man is. Okay, last thing on this story. What else has he said you'll get if you hang around, if you sort of, you know, you take the LPL deal?
Yeah, well, they've definitely, look, we talked about keeping the Commonwealth brand in place, keeping the conferences going. He has also discussed some product improvements, stuff around credit cards, cash management. So definitely offering service improvements as well. Okay. And that's part of the pitch.
There might be a story to come on that from Citywire RAA. So listener, you're getting a sneak peek and an exclusive. And
I don't know, maybe we should get into acting. That was a nice ego boost there.
It was very impressive. I think we've all enjoyed it greatly. Okay, so moving on now to our final story of the week. Back to you, Sam. And the state of the custodian market. So I suppose breaking news here, Charles Schwab's quite big.
Yeah, they're pretty big. And it's no surprise that on this recent custody report, which was produced by AdvisorPro, they were far and away the leading custodian that RIAs reported on their ADVs.
Okay, so this was a report out about sort of the size and shape of the custody market by a firm called AdvisorPro, which is you told me it's a software company.
Yeah.
To me, it's just a company that's found two different ways to spell advisor incorrectly, both a Z and an O in there, which is, you know.
AdvisorPro with a Z. Yeah, they provide client data to RIA firms.
From the edgy spelling, you know it's a tech firm. So look, fair play to them for that. And actually, look, it's a very good report. So no shade here. Fans of the firm. But what else was interesting in the report? So we know, okay, look, Schwab's number one. I'm guessing Fidelity's number two and Pershing's number three. But there's some other interesting stuff beyond that.
Yeah, well, there's some interesting insights on who's rising, who's up and coming in the custody world. And the report said, yeah, I mean, Altruist has shot up in terms of their market share. They were number 10 in circa early 2024. And now this report has them at number four.
Quite the rise. And this is based on, we should say, sorry, this is based on number of RIA clients or it's based on assets. What determines your ranking here?
That's based on the number of RIA clients as they disclosed in their ADV filings.
Okay. And as of March 31st?
As of March 31st, yep.
Okay. So Altruist has how many RIA clients?
Looks like 1,100.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. And that's good enough to be number four.
Yeah. Now Altruist claim. Yeah. Altruist's own numbers say they have over 3,000 RIA clients, but this report is using publicly available figures.
That might include like tech clients who might use it for custodial services potentially.
Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. And per the report, so I suppose what was the scale of their growth? How many had they added in that time to move from 10 to four? And I suppose my other question would then also be who's moved down or who do they replace in at number four?
Yeah, so this report has them at 111% growth over where they were in early 2024, which is the puts them at the top as far as other custodial players. And by jumping from 10 to four, you know, they've hopped some of the familiar names like Pershing, Northern Trust, players like that.
Wait, hang on a second, because I want to make sure we didn't get this one. They hop Pershing? Because I would have had Pershing in this three there.
Pershing's number five on this report. Interactive, yeah, so it's...
Listener, sorry, I stand corrected on what I said previously.
Yeah.
Okay, so who's number... Okay, do we have this information? I feel now we're jumping into the unknown.
Schwab's
one.
The far and away number one. Fidelity's solidly number two. This report has Interactive Brokers at number three.
Oh, okay. All right.
In terms of RIA clients. And then Altruist, and then we have Pershing.
Okay, this is also purely RIA clients, so that obviously you could have a bigger business than just RIAs.
Yeah.
Got it, fantastic. Again, Ian, come to you on this. Anything else we should take away from this? What does this tell us about sort of the state of play in the custodian landscape?
I think it's interesting. I mean, we want to talk about Altruist a little bit because when we were doing our little pitch meeting, that's kind of what we focus in on. I mean, Altruist has raised a ton of money. They just raised $152 million. They got a $1.9 billion enterprise valuation. And it's fascinating they've kind of gotten there because custody has historically been a very low margin business. I mean, we think about some of these biggest players. I mean, Schwab, Fidelity. Custody is, I don't want to say necessarily a loss leader, but when you think about those businesses as a general interest listener, you're not thinking about custody as the first thing you're thinking about, whether it's the asset management capabilities or the banking capabilities or the brokerage side of the house.
Sweet cash sweeps.
Cash sweep, yes. And so it's also worth knowing, look, Altruist is still raising money. At some point, you have this scale. You have to turn a profit, right? And they also, they did lay off.
Do we know that they do or they don't? We don't
know.
Not 100%
certain yet, but look, they did lay off about 10% of their staff heading into the start of the year.
But they've raised money since then.
Yes, they have raised money since then. The layoffs were reported in January, and Sam wrote about the capital raise in late April.
Yeah, since then they raised $152 million in a Series F that was led by a Singaporean sovereign wealth fund called GIC.
Oh, yeah, I remember the story. And Carson family office now, Ron Carson.
Yeah.
Or the artist formerly known as Ron Carson.
Yeah.
Invested it. Again, he's invested before. Okay, do we know much then about what they're going to spend that money on? What comes next for Ultrust?
Product development and like hiring people on the product team. That's seems to be the like chief area where they're going to spend. But it's so interesting on this report. You know, I mean, custody is also like such a hard industry to break into because it favors incumbents and altruists. You know, doing some pretty revolutionary stuff in the account opening area, just like making it easier for RIAs to open multiple accounts for clients and things like that seems to be part of the reason for their rise.
They're moving up the chain and maybe also as to why they've been backed heavily by these investors. Fantastic. Well, look, three very interesting stories that I think encapsulate, you know, the news flow this week and on a variety of topics from regulation to brokerage battles to custody. I don't know what more you could have wanted. Anything else to add before we go?
No, just I want to shoot. I can't make it an episode without at least one visual reference. But I want to make a shout out to Sam's Pittsburgh is for Champions, emphasis on the Y and Z shirt.
Okay, please explain it for me.
I have a reference to...
No, I don't understand.
Yeah, Pittsburgh has its own unique dialect. We use the term yins to denote you plural. And you can't see this. I'm wearing a Pittsburgh is for Champions shirt.
Okay, so like a y'all. That's like your version of y'all.
Yeah, it's like Pittsburgh's version of y'all, what they say down south. Yeah.
So you say yins.
Yeah.
Yep. Could you give me an example in a sentence?
Yins all want to run down to the store.
Okay, that makes no sense.
You are basically, you talk about your unlimited understanding of American sports and regional dialects. You're basically a modern-day Alexis de Tocqueville. This is basically democracy in America.
Yeah, lost by that reference too. Ian, thank you very much. Sam, thank you very much. Listener, thank you very much. And we'll be back again for another episode of This Week in Wealth soon. Thank you.